Welcome to Working the Lectionary, examining the world of work through the readings of the weekly lectionary. Hello and welcome to Working the Lectionary, a podcast in which the world of work is examined through readings from the weekly lectionary. My name is Brendan Byrne, and I am one of the co-hosts, and as always, it's my pleasure to welcome my co-host, John Bottomley.
G'day, Brendan.
In this episode, we will be examining readings for the 6th and 7th Sundays in the season of Pentecost, and the first of those readings for Pentecost 6 comes from the Gospel according to Matthew, chapter 11, various verses from verse 16 to verse 30.
A reading from the Gospel according to Matthew, chapter 11, verses 16 to 19, then 25 to 30. But to what will I compare this generation? It is like children sitting in the marketplaces and calling to one another. We played the flute for you, and you did not dance. We wailed, and you did not mourn. For John neither came eating nor drinking, and they say, he has a demon. And the Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they say, look, a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. Yet wisdom is vindicated by her deeds. At that time Jesus said, I thank you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, because you have hidden these things from the wise and the intelligent, and have revealed them to infants. Yes, Father, for such was your gracious will. All things have been handed over to me by my Father, and no one knows the Son except the Father, and no one knows the Father except the Son, and anyone to whom the Son chooses to reveal him. Come to me, all of you that are weary and are carrying heavy burdens, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light.
This gospel reading seems to present us with two scenarios. In the first, Jesus seems to be letting off a bit of steam, articulating the questions and criticisms that are directed at him. Questions and criticisms that reveal not so much things about Jesus as they do the expectations and assumptions of others and the complaints they then fall into when Jesus doesn't live up to their demands and assumptions about him. The second scenario seems to reflect Jesus' response to those criticisms and questions, that the good news which he bears doesn't conform itself to conventions and cultural standards, but in fact disrupts all of these in a manner which they themselves would condemn as foolish or irrational. He then issues an invitation to free ourselves from the yoke of these narrow conventional perspectives, to take upon ourselves the light yoke of relationship and engagement. John, it seems to me that in today's reading we have a challenge to reassess where we see God's presence in the world, to step outside all of our conventions and assumptions that prevent us from seeing God's grace and freedom in unexpected places. There also appears to be an invitation to set aside the burdens which our cultural and social myths place upon us, to accept our limitations as human beings, and set aside modernity's belief in autonomous individuality. So then, especially with respect to work and economy, how do you see this invitation as a reading to, as it were, for us to lean into Christ and accept his yoke as a gift?
Well, I'm going to jump straight in at the beginning here, Brendan, because I love this little dilemma that Matthew talks, you know, that John comes in neither eating nor drinking, and they say he's got a demon, he's not acting normally, and then they look at Jesus eating and drinking with other people that he shouldn't be and think he's a drunkard and a glutton.
Damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Exactly. So it reminded me two pieces of work that we did at Creative Ministries at Network back in the day. So we did a ground-piecing research on the impact of work-related deaths on employers.
Mm.
And it was so hard to find employers who were willing to engage with us about their experience.
Mm.
eventually we managed to get a mail out questionnaire that worked, and we got sort of anonymous responses, and we produced a report which was called Treated Like a Leper, which said something about one of the how employers felt they were treated by the employer associations, that once they had a work-related fatality, the body that was sort of set up to look after them and help them, blah, blah, didn't have much to do with them. And in fact, they were feeling quite abandoned by it. And so our report got quite a positive response from employers, but we got criticism from the trade union movement for sort of talking to employers and, you know, sort of weakening the argument against them because it showed them up. It really showed their humanity, how much they were struck by the grief of one of their employees being killed in a work incident. So the second piece of research we did was into work factors in suicide, and we interviewed a large number of families who were bereaved by suicide, and eventually we produced a report called Work Factors in Suicide, which actually got a run on, used to be called This Day Tonight, or the 7:30 report before it was 7:30, one of those ABC television things. And well, guess what? We got hammered by the employer bodies.
Yes.
And in fact, the TV report on our research had a quote from the executive, the CEO of one of the national employer bodies saying, you know, suicide's not a work-related issue, and, you know, employers don't want to have more sort of premium hikes, you know, to cope with these sorts of things. And I thought, gee, you know, Matthew's on the money here. Because what you have to take out of that, I think, is really knowing who you call by.
Yes.
And what you're calling is.
Yes.
And if you're playing to the audience, you're in trouble.
Yes.
So if I relied on the unions for support, or if I relied on the employers for support, I would always feel a failure, because that you can't please everybody in the public space. So if you're going to, as a Christian, be involved in public sort of action, I think the learning for me was sort of, again, just being aware of where my roots were in my vocation, and that the sort of the calling to do justice is both being merciful, so there's no boundaries on who my compassion might respond to, whether it was an employer or a unionist or a worker. If they were in pain and they were suffering and there was something that as an agency we could do, then we would do our best to do it. And clearly there are limitations, and we got caught out really trying to sort of mediate, if you like, between employers and unions, and that in the end was why we ended up doing research in restorative justice, because we didn't actually have a model in the pastoral care space that allowed us as an agency to be talking to both sides of what's a deeply divided industrial landscape, and how we really needed another institution like a restorative justice service to be in that space that could help injured workers or bereaved families talk to employers or to work, cover or work safe. And that gap still hasn't been filled. The project that we were working on to develop got swallowed up in the amalgamation into Uniting. I made several approaches to Uniting about picking it up after retirement, it never was. So there's a big hole there in the industrial space still. Even the restorative justice service that was set up at RMIT hasn't moved into that industrial space.
And it strikes me that that's emblematic of the gap, the void that I think exists within corporations and employers themselves. Because ideally, the human resources department ought to be a department that has the authority and the capacity to be able to mediate between employers and their employees, and be able to tell the truth to both sides and tell both sides when, you know, they're acting unfairly or inappropriately.
Yeah.
But the truth and the reality is that the HR department is all too often the club at the end of the executive arm.
Mm-hmm.
And doesn't actually fulfill that role that might otherwise be served by something like a restorative justice agency. So the void you speak of, is that a void that Jesus is speaking into in this passage in terms of the religious and political leadership of his day and the situation of the people of Israel?
I think I would say yes before I thought about why I could say yes. So I think Matthew has organised the material here immediately after an encounter, if you like, or a conversation around the work of John the Baptist, who was essentially, I mean, he's killed in the story a bit later than this, but for those who wrote the book, they knew that he was killed essentially by the complicit Jewish leadership. So it makes theological sense in terms of the unfolding of the narrative that this particular text about being caught on the one hand for doing X and caught on the other hand for doing Y is a pretty practical example in response to what happened to John the Baptist, that and trying to sort of curry favour doesn't guarantee you any safety, you know, sort of. So to me, the whole of this text that we're looking at, and particularly this that very sort of, I think, well-loved sort of last paragraphs, you know, about carrying heavy burdens and Jesus offering that, is speaking into that highly politicised conflict within the Jewish community about whether they politically are going to sort of carry favour and complicity with the Roman colonialists or whether they're going to go with the sort of Jewish nationalists and, you know, be a sort of political opposition or quiescent, you know, just keep your head down, have a drink, as it were.
Yeah.
So I think all the bases are covered in terms of Matthew sort of saying, look, the political options are bleak, but in Jesus there's somebody who offers a sort of a solidarity of suffering and a seat, if you like, at the throne of God, and that there's a comfort and a justice in God's mercy and so on to be paying attention to.
I want to touch on that second part of the reading a little later because I think it's incredibly relevant to the situation of the church today.
Sure.
But going back to what you were saying earlier about copping criticism from both sides because of doing research that spoke into the truth of both their realities.
Yeah.
It reminds me a little bit of that expression by the American comedian George Carlin, who once said that everyone loves your honesty until you're honest with them, and then you're an insensitive jerk, you know.
Yes.
And it seems to me that, you know, there's a lot of talk within the church, but also within wider society when we look at issues like inequality and climate change and all the rest of it. There's a lot of talk about venerating prophets or people who speak with prophetic voices.
Yes, yes.
And yet Jesus seems to be, in this passage, drawing our attention to the fact that, in fact, in reality, the opposite is the truth for both himself and John the Baptist.
Yep, exactly.
And there's a long tradition in the Hebrew scriptures of the prophets not being valued and appreciated in their own time and place. So what does this passage have to offer to us in terms of some of the realities of what it might mean for the church to speak prophetically to the world, but also what might be hopeful in that in terms of what the church could liberate itself from?
I think that the last verse of the text, so what are we looking at, verse 19? Wisdom is venerated, wisdom is vindicated by her deeds. So this really goes to the heart of what I'm doing some work on at the moment around Christian ethics. So ethics is not about what you think or what you might do, it's about what you do. And the judge of your ethics is actually what you do.
Yes.
So here I think Jesus is saying, you're going to get criticised from this side or from that side. And that reflects, that says more, as you said in your opening comment, about expectations of the people.
Mm.
And we saw in the Banking Royal Commission that the government sort of really weak sort of criteria was community expectations,
yeah,
for whether or not their misconduct is worth reporting or doing something about.
Mm.
And who knows what community expectations are. They didn't know in Jesus' day.
Yes.
It depended who you were friendly with.
Yes.
We don't know today what community expectations are because everything sits under the umbrella of capitalist sort of worldview.
Mm.
So this little sentence, wisdom is vindicated by her deeds, it punches a hole.
Yes.
In that sort of ideological umbrella.
Yes.
And says, no. You don't have to sit quietly here on the fence or be doing nothing or filling up your time with pastoral care or some other form of busyness.
Mm.
It's actually about your deeds. And your deeds have to be both prophetic and pastoral. It's always mercy and justice. Mm. There's no division, you know, in the kingdom between the two. Mm. So to my mind, when we're thinking about ministry in the world of work, we need to be wise, if you like, and to have a wisdom that is committed to action, and then sort of thinking about how that action is integrated or assessed in terms of mercy and justice, and being attentive to the balance of those, or not so much the balance, but the interplay of those. I think that it's interesting that, just to go back to the word play, that it sort of opens with this sort of scenario of kids sort of mucking around.
Yes. Yes.
And I think that that's a nice sort of sarcastic comment on church life, you know, really.
Well,
it looks like kids mucking around from here.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, is that, could that be interpreted as the church is mucking around and being like kids playing in the marketplace, while the quote-unquote serious work of the market is going on around us, you know, we're wondering why the rest of the world is ignoring us. Well, it's because we're effectively ignoring the rest of the world.
Mm. And it's rather cute in a way that, that the whole thing is punctured by this very sort of short sentence about wisdom.
Mm.
And I would have thought you had a vested interest in promoting Sophia.
Yeah.
As a sort of a life-giving sort of insertion into that market madness.
Yes.
And actually, there's a deeper truth here.
Yeah. And indeed, the deep folly of the market, because nothing has come out of that Royal Commission.
No.
And so if wisdom is visible in its acts, then the Royal Commission and its outcomes are devoid of wisdom, and the market continues in its folly.
It certainly does.
So if we go then to that second part of the reading where Jesus talks about being liberated and taking up his much easier yoke, at the beginning in my introduction, I spoke of how it's perhaps an invitation to set aside the blinkers and the narrowness of our conventions and assumptions which cause us to respond to Jesus and prophetic figures like John the Baptist in the way the first half describes, and to in fact take up the invitation, the yoke of relationship and engagement. But as we've been talking, I've been thinking that it certainly, insofar as the church is situated today, could this be, in fact, an invitation for the church to jettison its addiction to certain forms and ways of being church that we cling to in terms of the church's property and location and building and, you know, people gathered for worship in a certain form and way, etc.?
Yes.
And our misbelief that in fact represents how the church has always been, instead of the reality that it's in fact a relatively recent phenomenon.
Yeah, yeah.
And an invitation into a more relational, engaged church that in some ways is more difficult and less comforting in terms of its structured reality, but in fact might be more life-giving.
So the key word, as I listen to you putting that question or comment, is relational. So we've got two verses from 25, 26, 27, three verses where Jesus is talking about his relationship with the Father.
Yes.
And it echoes that Johannine sort of picture of John 1.
Indwelling and yes.
So the fact that it echoes or resonates with that, I think, just brings it forward for me that Jesus is actually claiming that the relationship that he had with God is actually the foundation of who he is. And that if people want to understand who God is, they can have a look at him because the relationship is disclosing.
Mm.
And just to, if you didn't get that sort of picture of the metaphor, it concludes that all of that relational sort of material is available to anyone to whom the Son chooses to reveal him.
Yes.
That is, if we have a relationship with Christ, then that relationship allows us to see purposes of God and to be in relationship with God.
Mm.
And for me, where the church gets off track its understanding is when we go into the sort of mission space and we sort of have this sense that we've been sent and somehow there's a piece of elastic and it keeps stretching and stretching and we haven't realized that it broke some time ago and the relationship is no longer the focus. It's about how we're so important that we've been sent. And to my mind, the text just brings us back to the importance of the relationship.
Yes.
And for me, that's critical because I couldn't have survived in doing work with families bereaved by work-related death and particularly work-related suicide if I didn't have if I didn't know that I was called back into the bosom of God. To sort of be nurtured in prayer in the grace of God and to struggle with what God was actually wanting to reveal to me about the world through this heartbreaking sort of injustices. And it really meant reimagining what God's judgment was, which I think I grew up thinking that was a judgment on individuals for doing bad things. I came to believe that God was with those who suffered these injustices in God's grief and at the injustices in the world that allowed such terrible things to happen to people.
Yes.
And that any work-related death was an act of God's judgment, not on the individual. That was an act of state and corporate, you know, capitalist sort of injustice. That's what that was. Mm. That was the crucifixion.
Mm.
You know, that's not God's hand here. This is the hand of self-serving idolatry.
Yes.
The judgment is on that idolatry.
Yes.
Can't you see that this is unjust, that this is against God's will?
Yes.
And on that basis, I was renewed in my vocation to be in solidarity with those people, to stand with them, with God, in God's grief and God and Christ's suffering, to say, oh God, deliver us from this. You know, so that the only way really to be in pastoral solidarity was prayerfully.
Yes.
If you didn't know that you needed God's help to be there, you weren't going to be there with the sort of integrity that the person needed, that you were there for them, not for any accolades or any, you know, aren't we doing terrific work here? Which is the Uniting Church doing more rah, rah, rah? No. That's not what it's about. So that's why I think Christ's yoke is gentle.
Yes.
It's a yoke that I would pick up or that would God allow Christ to lay on my shoulders because it yoked me to the source of my life and the source of my ministry. And so the burden was taken away. I never felt that being with people in that tragedy was a burden. Never. And yet when I talk to people about that, they always say, how can you do that? Isn't that terrible? Isn't that a burden? Isn't that, doesn't it, you know, why don't you suffer from burnout? That was never the issue for me.
So as a preacher, engaging with this text, wanting to link it to our experience of work, where's the focus? What's the central message here?
Well, it might depend a bit on who or where I'm at as a preacher, but because of my age now and the fact that I've lived through the last sort of say 5 years of Mum's life and death, and talked to her about her sisters who all died, both died before Mum.
Mm.
But the mantra that comes out of being there is that you can't help but hear regularly with people supporting elderly people, elderly relatives, parents particularly. I don't want to be a burden. I don't want to be a burden. So I did a piece of research with Palliative Care Victoria to look at how workplaces could support their employees if they had a life-threatening illness. Same phrase comes up.
Yes.
Amongst people who've got cancer.
Yes.
And it drives people away.
Yes.
I don't want to be a burden.
Yes.
But what the text is saying here is if you don't want to be a burden, then Christ can't lay his lighter yoke on you.
Yes, yes.
So you need to accept that you are a burden that you can't carry. And there's no medals for being a hero here or for being the sort of the best man in the room.
Yes.
Because that level of patriarchy is going to kill you.
Yes.
It will, literally, it will kill you.
Yeah.
So let it go. Just let it go. So if I'm preaching, I'd be saying to men, if you're having some chest pain, you're having trouble breathing when you're walking, do what I did. Walk into the emergency department and tell the triage nurse that you're short of breath.
Yep.
And they'll have a look at you and now I've got a stent and I'm still here to preach to you.
Yeah.
Whatever burden that you think you are, if you haven't disclosed it to God and opened your heart to God, then you're just choosing to shorten your life.
And is it letting go, too, of those identities that we invest in through work, through our careers, etc.?
Exactly.
That are, in fact, killing us.
Exactly, because the self-actualizing is a myth. It's a myth. There's no self-actualizing, really. It's all storytelling based on a lie.
Yes.
The fruitfulness of my life is in God's hands.
Yes.
Nothing that I do for myself.
Yes.
And if I sort of spend a whole lot of time trying to create a myth about my super sort of powers, the only person I'm fooling is myself.
Yes.
So I woke up to that after open heart surgery and also from being in a men's group for 15 years. And the joy that comes from sharing your sort of vulnerabilities with other, for me, that came with sharing with other men was life-giving. And that's why even today when I'm talking about peer support, it's actually born on that, born out of that experience. And the whole, you look where that peer support movement has taken off. It's in the mental health area. It's amongst people who have had a lived experience of being treated abysmally by the mental health system, but have found comfort in sharing their stories with other who've been on that journey. And today, it's an international movement
you know,
against work systems that have been defined by a medical view of the human condition rather than a, well, I would say a spiritual vision at least. And I think from a Christian point of view, this text speaks right into that, that what the church is, I think, is being called to is a community of peers. And what do we share? We share our sin. We're all sinners. There was a basic Wesleyan proposition. And as clergy, something that if I'm quoting, misquoting Wesley, I'll apologise beforehand, but Wesley, I think, would have said that something like his ministers were first amongst sinners. So we can't go to the pulpit as if that's a sort of a sacred place that raises us up above.
Yes.
It's actually a place that puts us on the same level. And by God's grace, we can open our hearts to the congregation and say, gee, we're all here today again, you know, to confess our failures and to ask God's forgiveness and to help us reorientate our lives.
Well, I think on that liberating note, it's time that we now move to our reading for Pentecost 7, which comes from the book of Genesis, chapter 25, verses 19 to 34.
A reading from the book of Genesis, chapter 25, verses 19 to 34. These are the descendants of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he married Rebekah, daughter of Bethuel the Aramaean of Padan Aram, sister of Laban the Aramaean. Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord granted his prayer, and his wife Rebekah conceived. The children struggled together within her, and she said, "If it is to be this way, why do I live?" So she went to inquire of the Lord, and the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples born of you shall be divided. One shall be stronger than the other, the elder shall serve the younger." When her time to give birth was at hand, there were twins in her womb. The first came out red, all his body like a hairy mantle, so they named him Esau. Afterwards his brother came out with his hand gripping Esau's heel, so he was named Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. When the boys grew up, Esau was a skilled hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man living in tents. Isaac loved Esau because he was fond of game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Once when Jacob was cooking a stew, Esau came in from the field and he was famished. Esau said to Jacob, "Let me eat some of that red stuff, for I am famished." Therefore he was called Edom. Jacob said, "First sell me your birthright." Esau said, "I am about to die. Of what use is a birthright to me?" Jacob said, "Swear to me first." So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank, and rose and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright.
Now, in this reading, it seems to me that we have a theme that we've touched upon before, a theme articulated through the motif of rivalry and contest between siblings. And in Genesis especially, we see it in Cain and Abel, in Isaac and Ishmael, and in today's reading we see it in Jacob and Esau, just as in the future it will reoccur with Joseph and his brothers. And this repeated motif is offering the view that the story of God's promise to Abraham and God's faithfulness to that promise is not founded on the alleged merits of various human actors, all of whom are flawed and limited, and who tend to be somewhat preoccupied and self-focused. Indeed, the narrative doesn't sugarcoat the various personality and character flaws of those who presume to walk in God's way, a reality that highlights both the difficulty of God's promise being sustained in the face of human selfishness, but also the extent of God's grace which continues, notwithstanding the shallowness of human intent. So, John, given how pervasive the ideology of hard work has become in modern life, and how the promises it makes about how we can build a reality that, for ourselves, that matches our own self-focused wants and desires, what does this reading offer us by way of a reminder, or possibly even a warning, about the intentional graciousness of God that has its own purposes, our self-obsessions notwithstanding?
We're back to the tough questions, Brendan.
I can't let you off too lightly, John.
But I think one of the things that struck me about the value of working with you on the podcast is you start to sort of see how focusing on the lectionary sort of week by week can leave you sort of trapped in a very small vision.
Mm.
And so your introduction sort of placing the reading into that larger context is really important, because I can, like, this is a Sunday school story.
Yes.
I can remember this sort of story from being a kid. And you thought, oh, it's a really funny sort of a story.
Yes.
But when you sort of see it as part of a context of aging mothers who have trouble giving birth to heirs, and what's happening, why is that? That's actually important. You don't see that in this selection of text, nor do you necessarily see that, oh, this is brothers fighting again. You know, that this is actually another theme across Genesis, and why is that important again? And so once you sort of locate the text within its larger textual context, it opens up some important sort of things. And the important point, if you like, of the book of Genesis is the Abraham story, if you like, you know, that sets up the promise of God. And the reason why that's important for the construction of the Hebrew Bible is that allows, like the Moses story which follows and sets up the whole experience of Torah in the exile, to actually have a counter-narrative, if you like, that God was with Israel, which is Israel comes out of this particular story next week or the week after in the lectionary, but God was setting up a counter-narrative through Abraham. So the blessing, well, the covenant starts with Abraham, and then, well, the covenants keep getting renewed at different times according to different disasters. So what then is the focus, it as you've reframed it and helpfully reframed it, is the promise.
Yes.
So God makes the promise to Abraham, and then he's got to deal with all these human foibles.
Yes, yes.
And it really doesn't matter how bad they are. I mean, you know, like you mentioned Cain and Abel, so that's death, it's a murder. Here's straight out jealousy and coveting your brother's goods. I mean, they're nasty things. So we're not supposed to read this as that, like, this is a hero story. This is my story, you know, this is me sort of grasping after fame, you know, like I can remember as a young minister, well, I'm going to set the world on fire with my sort of radical ministry. This is about what God brings out of our, you know, sort of half-baked and selfish sort of
creators. Yes, yes.
Primarily, that's, I think, the thing here.
And, well, I would argue you did have a radical ministry, but perhaps not in the way you intended.
Well, I think that's, again, I think part of the wisdom of God, that God works with what we do to bring about something that's in aligned with God's purpose.
Yes.
And for me, going to the outer suburbs for 9 years, my first placement, that was the decision of the church. But it placed me on the edge of the city, and it encouraged me to read about suburban life as part of the development of the city, and then to reread the sort of the story of the city in Scripture as really the place of rejection of God, and we've got the whole Tower of Babel right there at the beginning. So I think you're right. That sort of 9 years has been formative for why I'm comfortable now being, in some sense, on the margins of the politics of the church, because there's a space there to be attentive to God's calling, which the closer you get to the heart of the church, the less freedom there is to be attending.
Yes.
You know, and the church is actually burying, I think, its ministers and its congregations with busyness. And, I mean, I've been a very busy minister as well. So again, retirement, I think you're outside the busy work of the church, and, and so I feel my work's more productive, if you like, or fruitful, maybe not so much productive, just to find a better word.
Well, but that does, doesn't that just show you that even with the best intentions, we get trapped within the lexicon of economic and social orthodoxy. It's about being productive as distinct from fruitful.
And I think that's lovely that you picked up on that, because, again, that's really at the heart of the story. The names Esau and the names Jacob and all the names, they're always, they have a meaning. If it's not in the text, it'll be in a commentary that's meaning. So Esau means like the red one or something like that. Just the fact that either he's got red hair or there's something red about him that, that the text tells. I think, what did I read about Jacob, sort of?
Doesn't
the one Esau, who grabs.
yes, that's right. Yes, and doesn't Esau, like Ishmael, become the ancestor figure for some of the peoples who the traditional enemies of Israel.
And I wonder whether the Edomites are actually the redheads. I wonder if this is sort of a ginger story.
Yeah. You know? And the irony here is that one of the remote descendants of the Edomites will be Herod the Great, who is not a Jew, but an Idumean.
Okay.
Who were the descendants of the Edomites.
Okay. Yeah.
So in the context of who inherits what, there's a lovely little irony there.
Yeah. But just to go back to the point that you make about the choice of words in the lexicon, the Hebrew scriptures in particular, I think, but also the importance of naming is in that the name encapsulates, if you like, the character of the person.
Yes.
What have we got with Jerusalem? Is that like, peace or something like that? Or, you know, that there are names, the meaning of name important. And I think, to follow through with your point, it reminds us as preachers to be thoughtful about words.
Yes.
I sort of regret that there was not more poetry in my training, more sort of, if you like, enculturation into language, not just being wordy for the sake of preaching, you know, like being wordy, but actually having a love for words and a care for words. And you see that coming out with the issue as I read about the statement from the heart and what's happening in Indigenous Australia, that the sort of significant attempt that's been made amongst Indigenous communities to recover their language and the terribly sad and brutal stories of mission places where, you know, kids are getting whacked over their head for using devil language.
Yes, you know,
calling their own language. So all that just speaks into the importance of language and the importance of solidarity with Indigenous people.
And all imperial powers have banned the use of language in conquered and colonised peoples.
Okay.
You know, the English did it to the Scottish and the Irish.
Yep.
They did it in South Africa to the Afrikaans
and
to the Indigenous peoples in Africa. Mm. You know, it's a repeated motif throughout history that the imperial power bans the use of language because language forms part of the basis of identity.
Well, you see, that speaks to the importance, not in today's reading, but a bit further along, when God gives Jacob a new name.
Yes.
Same with the New Testament, with Simon.
Yes.
Gets a new name.
Yes. And we saw it in the reading for Pentecost 5, where Abraham calls the mountain where he was taken to sacrifice Isaac, God looks up. This is the place where God sees. So in this text we have a caution, as it were, for preachers to have a care for the language they use.
I think so. Because the story is actually quite explicit about the danger of lies. You know, to the point that, you know, the father sort of backseat the son, the older son, the mother backs the younger. And so you get this sort of factionalism within families around what? Paying attention to the names and the relationships. And I suppose when I first thought about it, I thought, you know, there's an emphasis on truth-telling in the air at the moment. And it's come about through the statement from the heart, emphasising the importance of truth-telling.
Yes.
And everyone sort of, I think, feels a bit of a warm glow about that. But truth-telling is painful.
Yes.
And I'm sort of aware that it's also an awesome responsibility. So as a preacher, am I just getting up and helping people to feel comfortable?
Yeah.
And if I have a truth to say, which I'm happy to preach about, what I think is God's judgment on the church, as a subset of God's judgment on Western culture, and the church, because of its complicity in Western culture, bears some of that disintegration and bears some of that grief and pain. I've been interested to preach about that in several congregations because I don't have a regular congregation or a preaching place, and typically find members of the congregation quite responsive to that. You know, that there's the truth is liberating for many in that context. I mean, some people don't want to hear it, but generally they're the people who have got the biggest investment in the structure.
And if we take the example of South Africa, their commission was called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission because it recognised that reconciliation is not possible without truth telling.
And
we do a lot of talk in the church about and wider society about reconciliation, and we kind of leave out that first bit.
True.
You know, looking at this text and considering the wider context into which it falls, it reminds me of something that Abraham Lincoln said at the height of the American Civil War, when he said that, you know, both sides of this conflict believe themselves to be acting righteously. Yes. We both pray to the same God. We both call on God to aid our cause. We both justify our cause in terms of the God in who we purport to follow.
Yes.
But God cannot be for and against the same thing. Both sides may be, but one side must be wrong. Because the Almighty has his own purposes, and this constant struggle for the grace of God to sustain itself through repeated generations of human folly and ambition and self-absorption.
Yes.
And yet the intentionality of that graciousness, notwithstanding, is quite an extraordinary thread that runs through all these narratives. And so I'm wondering where today, with our own forms of self-absorption, with our own mythologies of self-actualization, where can we be attentive to that thread of intentional graciousness? Is it perhaps in those moments of solidarity where people who've been harmed turn to one another in their vulnerability?
Yes, I think so. But I think there's a prior turning, if you like.
Yep.
So in the narrative, you've got this genealogy, which leads us to Rebecca, who is barren, hasn't given birth to a child, and that is problematic. So the genealogy sort of, it raises the question, is he going to stop? Is there no heir? Has God's promise been thwarted by this woman not being able to conceive? Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife because she was barren. And the Lord granted his prayer, and his wife Rebecca conceived.
And we've, as you noted earlier, we've seen that before as well with Sarah. So with the constant conflicts between the family members and the biological realities of what it means to be human, there are considerable hurdles at play here.
Yes. Well, Rebecca's even unhappy with the pregnancy.
Yeah.
You know, she sees that she's got twins and they're fighting within her. And she said, if it's to be this way, why do I live? So that's like, she's suicidal. Ideation here. And so she went to inquire to the Lord. And the Lord basically says, yes, there is a fight going on inside you. And the older one is going to serve the younger, which must have sounded like heresy. That's not the way we've been doing it.
That's right, yes.
So Rebecca has got this sort of word from the Lord that, yes, she's going to have twins, and the younger one's going to end up being served by the older one. How did you live with that?
And we've seen that before with Ishmael and Isaac.
Exactly. So these are real conflicts, and I suppose we've got to this because you asked the question, where does the sort of space for grace open up? And you'd have to say that Rebecca, having been comforted about the difficulty of her pregnancy, doesn't have any insight into that she, in fact, favours the younger, the secondborn, Mike, and that does that push the older boy to the father? Who knows? But the, if you like, the revelation simply justifies her choice of the younger one as her favourite. But that's not. He doesn't get to inherit the blessing because he's her favourite. So I think your earlier question, right, as you introduced it, is do we read this story as how are we to read it? Is it a warning about claiming that our God's revelation to us, maybe our calling, our sense of I'm called by God and that justifies everything I do? Goes back to what we were talking about from Matthew's gospel, about wisdom. Wisdom's in the deed. And the deeds up till now are pretty grubby.
Yes.
How'd you like a bowl of soup, my brother?
Yes.
Oh, I'll give you a bowl of soup if you sell me your birthright.
Yes.
I mean, if that doesn't remind you of John Batman, who does it remind you of?
Yes, exactly.
Pretty grubby deal. Treaty? Sure, we'll give you treaty.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course, Jacob goes on to prove his trickery later in his dealings with his uncle Laban. Who himself is a bit of a, you know.
You have to be sharp in this world, don't you?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what, if there was no God in this story, you'd think this is about being smarter than the next. Not, you know, we're not talking about brotherly love here. We're talking about brotherly enmity.
Yes. So, go back to that question. Where's the thread of grace? Is it in that warning that God is operating in the background, our own agendas notwithstanding?
I struggle to see the grace in these verses.
Yeah.
Apart from the fact that they are so thorough in discounting human strength and human perspicacity. You know, like there's no ability to see into the horizon here. It's all grabbing for the moment. And there's no covering up.
So is it then when we recognize that reality that the potential for grace arrives?
I believe so.
Yes. So the point of these texts is to help us recognize a reality, to say, you know, this is a lousy situation and there's nothing redeeming it at all, and it's all about some of the baser, lowest human instincts and reactions.
Yes.
And it's when we name that reality that we become capable of something, of being open to something else.
I'd say that we, in a sense, can only name it to the extent that we can believe or see that God is actually at work in the background and is not put off. You know, God's not saying, oh, you lot are hopeless, I'm going to pack up on you. You know, the bat and ball and go home sort of response.
Yes.
And you mightn't see that if you didn't read into the story a bit further. If you just pick that out and sometimes I do this with a congregation, just read the lectionary reading, and people just sit there dumbfounded. What can that mean? If you don't have some picture of what the whole story is when you come to these particular texts, you may miss that because you think, oh, this is beyond belief, you know.
Yes.
It's not beyond belief. This is actually a very truthful depiction of the human condition.
Yes.
Without God, but we can come to see it for what it is because we know something of God's presence in the midst of all this sort of stuff.
And could it be, and perhaps I'm being slightly mischievous here, but could it be, and touching on our discussion around the reading for Pentecost 6, could it be that part of our problem with these texts is that because we approach them as holy texts, we expect them to be elevated and uplifting and to make us feel good about ourselves. But what in fact they're doing is they're taking us into the grubby realities of what it means to be human, and we don't like that.
We're silly if we don't like it.
Yeah.
Because the truth is actually liberating. So the only reason, I mean, this is, I think, the old Amazing Grace sort of song. The only reason, the only time that you actually know your sin is through the gift of grace. Up until, without grace, you just imagine you're sinning. You know, because you've got a list of sins on the blackboard or whatever.
Yes.
And, oh, I must be that one.
Yes.
But so here, the gift of love is part of the overall story that God's love is not conditional. It's not excusing this bad behavior, but it's saying at any moment that you choose, you can open your heart to it. It's there all the time. We're not, God's not waiting for you to be a good boy.
Yes.
In fact, God's waiting for you to recognize God's goodness.
Yes. Yes.
And that means accepting that you can't save yourself. You can't do this self-actualizing.
Yes.
You can't be the top salesman. You can't be the top professor.
Yes.
There's no virtue in that.
Yes. And of course, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob don't become the ancestors of a great nation through their own power and merit.
No, it's a gift all the time.
Yes.
And the narrative keeps coming back to the blessing of God.
So is that for preachers the key focus of this passage?
Yeah, I think so. I think It's the precondition for every sermon, for every preaching, that people are invited to hear the good news of the gospel, out of calling them out of the brokenness of their human condition or our human condition. So if the preaching doesn't actually touch the depth of our lostness, then the good news has got to be shallow.
Yes.
We're not a cheer squad for God.
Yes.
We're telling a story about human, and we're trying to connect with the story of God.
Yes.
So I think to do that, we have to understand the story that's in front of us.
Yes.
And that we're reading a part of it, and we're actually reading a very significant part of the story here. But its significance is in its depiction, I think, of how depraved, I suppose, humans can be, you know, like... If I can sell my birthright to my brother for a bowl of soup, what sort of values have I got about my own life?
Yes,
none.
Yes.
And that's in the text.
Yes.
He says, Jacob says, sell me your birthright. And Esau says, I'm about to die. What use is a birthright to me?
Yes.
So his view of himself is, my life counts for nothing. I'd rather have a bowl of soup.
Yes. And that prior reality of gifting and of God's faithfulness.
Yes.
Like, again, the text for Pentecost 6 liberates us, sets us free.
Yeah, I think so.
Because we don't have to measure our worth by the standard of what we achieve.
No.
And that's a powerful message in the context of modernity's myth of autonomous individuality.
I think that's exactly right.
Well, then, I think at that point we can draw our conversation for today to a close. In our next episode, we'll look at readings for the 8th and 9th Sundays of the Pentecost season. But for now, John, thank you as always for your company today.
Good to be with you again, Brendan.
If you'd like to leave any comments, suggestions, or feedback, please go to the podcast website at www.workingthelectionary.podbean.com. Working the Lectionary is available on Podbean, the hosting service for this podcast, but it is now also available through Google Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, TuneIn, and iHeartRadio. In the meantime, John and I look forward to your company for the next episode. Goodbye for now.
This has been Working the Lectionary, examining the world of work through the readings of the weekly lectionary.